I've got a little list. The top 10 shows of 2010 on Writer's Voice.
The stories are a journey, and often I think I may find X and I find Y. And in the case of that Sherlock Holmes story, I think it's fair to say that I found Z. I mean, I found something that I never, ever would have contemplated was the possible resolution to that mystery.
That's journalist David Grand talking about his true story collection, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes. We'll hear an excerpt from our June 9th interview with him, along with clips from other shows we aired this year on our top 10 list for 2010. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Well, it's that time of year, folks. Time for the top 10 lists. Here on Writer's Voice, we like to let you savor an interview, so we'll only have time to air 7 clips from the top 10 shows of 2010. Go to writersvoice.net for a complete list and to find links to the full interviews. First up on our roster, which is in no particular order, is New York staff writer David Grand. We talked to him in June about his wonderful collection of stories, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. This is the second time he's made the Best Ten list. He made it last year for The Lost City of Z. The Devil and Sherlock Holmes is a collection of 12 true stories. In this clip, Grand unlocks the mystery behind the title story about a real person who lost his life over a fictional character. Richard Lancelin Green was the world's foremost expert on Sherlock Holmes,
who was found dead in very mysterious circumstances. He's garroted, and nobody knows exactly what happened. And he was garroted, at the time he was garroted, he was investigating, trying to track down a lost archive of papers by Conan Doyle, which he believed had been stolen. And in the pursuit of these papers, he begins to warn people that his life is in danger and that he is being threatened by a mysterious American figure. And then he is suddenly found garroted. And the case is taken up by all these amateur Sherlock Holmes sleuths and who see this case as greater than anything, you know, more difficult than anything that Conan Doyle had ever written about in Sherlock Holmes. And so the story is really about both the obsession with reason and with literary and art of detection and trying to piece together stories. Richard Lancelin Green was deeply obsessed with Sherlock Holmes, so it taps into this theme of obsession, which is in the book, and this kind of fundamental need of ours to try to make sense of the world, to process the world like Sherlock Holmes. The difference is, and that's part of the point of this story and the point of all of these stories, is that none of us are Sherlock Holmes. Richard Lancelin Green isn't. I'm not as a writer. We are all mortal. We are all fallible. And so even though we try to piece together these stories perfectly, we can't always see everything as clearly. And it's what makes these stories real, and at least to my mind, more fascinating than a Sherlock Holmes story, which is in many ways like a fairy tale.
So are you saying that obsession, and I have to say, you're a pretty obsessive person yourself.
Yes. I mean, I'm fairly mild-mannered in almost every other form of my life, but when I do work on these stories, very much like the characters are trying to piece together the stories, I often become consumed with them, and I will spend more time and end up doing things I would not ordinarily do in pursuit of the stories.
So what is the nature of obsession? You're talking about a concept here where we can never see all the parts of things. Is there something that's innate in us that drives us to try to find out what is the mystery, and that it's not even the goal, it's the process?
I think it's both. I think that there is something deeply innate, very human in us. It's why I write stories, but why people tell stories, and why stories, whether you go back to the Bible, whether you look at literature during every era, there is a sense, an almost organic, innate sense of humans to tell stories, to move people, and to try to kind of fit the pieces of a puzzle, which is our lives. And that puzzle can be anything. I mean, it could be Richard Lancelin Green's puzzle, both of him trying to unravel who Conan Doyle really was so he can write his biography and discern where these missing papers are, and then people investigating his case to try to figure out what happened to him to kind of explain this inexplicable death. It can be like in another story in the collection about a fireman who lost his memory on 9/11 and all his men perished who he was with but him, and he's haunted by this question of why he alone survived and is trying to piece together what happened on that day. So I think all these things were all driven to try to understand our world and the world around us and to be able to kind of communicate it to us. So I do think that is our need. I think that is our process. And I do think that the object is also often important as well, but we don't often or we don't always obtain the object. The object can be elusive, and that doesn't stop us. And so, for example, there is a story in the collection about scientists stalking the elusive giant squid, this almost semi-mythological creature with tentacles that are as long as 30 feet. Some of you measured at 60 feet with eyes that are the size of human heads. And I go out with this kind of with this giant squid hunter who spent his life trying to track one down, and it always remains just out of his reach. He gets so close so often, and that doesn't stop him.
Yeah, that's a very frustrating one. I that was one in which I really hoped he would find that squid, but he doesn't. And you, about the first story of Richard Lansland Green, I don't want to give away the ending because unlike a lot of the stories where I think, you know, you can talk about what happens, this one is truly a mystery. But I do want to ask you, were you surprised when you found out what really happened?
Yes, incredibly so. And one of the things these stories, I hope they convey, is when I begin these stories, I often know very little about them. I begin kind of at a flat beginning, the same way the reader does. And the stories are a journey. And often I think I may find X and I find Y. And in the case of that Sherlock Holmes story, I think it's fair to say that I found Z. I mean, I found something that I never, ever would have contemplated was the possible resolution to that mystery.
David Grand's book is The Devil and Sherlock Holmes. I met up with novelist Isabel Allende at the offices of her publisher, Harper. Her historical saga of Haiti, Island Beneath the Sea, has been called a tale of poetics and cruelty that coalesces into something like a diamond.
The book is the story of the slave revolt in the French colony of Saint-Domingue, which is now Haiti. And it's the story of a person who, a slave who is born there, and then the second part of the book happens in New Orleans. The slaves in Haiti had only two ways of liberation, death and escaping. Many escaped, and of course, many were killed too. The life in the plantations was horrible, and they thought that when they died, their souls would go to the island beneath the sea, and that was Guinea, paradise, because they had come by sea, and many of them had been kidnapped in Africa and had never seen the ocean before. And they thought the only way back to the old life, to paradise, to Africa, would be to go to the island beneath the sea.
As you say, this is a story of a slave. She is a remarkable character, Tete. Tell us about her.
The book begins when she's 9 years old and she's sold to a plantation owner. And she's supposedly to be the handmaid of the wife of the plantation owner, who is Spanish, and she is mad. Many European women who married people in the colonies, men in the colonies, and were taken to these very isolated places, the plantations, went mad. They couldn't stand the weather, they couldn't stand the mosquitoes, and the climate of terror in which everybody lived. The slaves, because they had terrible lives, and the whites, because they feared that they would be poisoned, assassinated, that there would be a rebellion. The slaves were revolting all the time, so it was not as if life was easy for the whites either. It was a horrible life for everybody.
Yes, you really do go into the impact of the intertwined relationships, the dependence of the whites upon their slaves, emotional as well as physical or financial, and the tremendous toll that it takes psychologically on people.
Yes, there is a point in the book after the slave revolt when the whites have to escape, and the master, Tete's master, who is called Toulouse Valmorin, takes her and the children to New Orleans. And there he buys another plantation. But there the conditions of the slaves is very, very different, because in Saint-Domingue they were disposable. They were so cheap that the idea was to exploit them to death. So in 4 or 6 years in the fields they would die and they would be replaced. And that was economically more sound than humane treatment. However, in Louisiana, the trade, slave trade, was already forbidden. So slaves became very expensive. Therefore, it was an investment of capital. There were also rules about the treatment of slaves, and people didn't accept cruelty very easily. It wasn't at all the life in the plantation. So the life of the slaves that were taken with the masters to New Orleans changed dramatically when they arrived there. And there's a point in the book when Toulouse Valmorin buys the new plantation and the rules of the game are different, and he gets an overseer who is a kind man. And he feels relieved because he feels that the absolute power that he had over the people in the plantation in Saint-Domingue tested his humanity constantly. And he was a man that was against slavery at the beginning, and then when he becomes the plantation owner, he has to deal with the problem. And the other thing is that we know in the book, although he doesn't say it, that he loves Tete. He's attached to her, and he will not emancipate her, although he owes her her emancipation, because he doesn't want to lose her. So in the book, there is all these connections that people had that were family connections often. And of course, there's the horror of rape and incest and everything else. But nothing is simple in these relationships. They were very complex, complicated.
And in discovering that, because it's evident that you did prodigious research in this book, it is just a marvelous view into this time. In doing this, how did you discover this kind of this fraught relationship between master and slave? I mean, after all, Valmorin, you're right, he was against slavery to begin with, and then he was in favor of it. When it comes time for Tete to declare her independence to him and really demand what is due her because she had saved his life and the life of his children, he's outraged.
He doesn't understand why she's not grateful. They have lived together 40 years or 30 years, and Valmorin thinks of her as his property, but also as part of his family. He's attached to her and depends on her, and so he doesn't understand why she doesn't feel the same way toward him. He feels betrayed when she wants her freedom. You know, for me, it wasn't that difficult to imagine all this, because I come from a country where there was practically no slavery. We didn't have plantations in Chile, and we didn't have African slaves, but we enslaved the indigenous people, the Indians. And Chile is a very class-oriented society. And I grew up in an environment where people were divided by classes. And that kind of relationship in which you have, for example, the nanny that brings up the children at home, and she's treated, she doesn't eat at the table with you, she often doesn't eat the same food. She lives in a room in the back of the house that is almost a cell. I'm talking, of course, about the 50s. It isn't that way anymore in Chile at all. This has changed completely. But this is how I was brought up. And this was natural. And for me, it was never natural. I was 5 years old, and I could see that there was something basically wrong. And when the nanny would say, "I'm fed up, I'm leaving," the family would feel betrayed. She was a member of the family. She had brought up the children. She was like a mother for the children. Why on earth would she leave? Why would she want a life of her own? She already has a life here. So I do understand how these things work.
Isabel Allende's novel is Island Beneath the Sea. Listen to the whole wonderful interview she gave us at writersvoice.net. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking today about the Writer's Voice Top 10 list of shows for 2010. East Hampton, New York is where poet Philip Schultz makes his home. At a local bookstore, I'd heard him read from The God of Loneliness, his latest poetry collection, and was struck by the compassionate sensibility he brings to his poems about families, friends, and ordinary life. I had no idea that he suffers from a disability, dyslexia. Quite a disability for a poet, but it was something he very much wanted to talk about. Now, you mentioned dyslexia. Are there ways in which your dyslexia has added to your work as a poet?
It's very perceptive. In writing this book, I've discovered that my life is very different from the one I thought I was leading. Dyslexia plays an enormous part in ways that I didn't know until I was 58 that I was dyslexic, when my son in second grade, my oldest son, was diagnosed with it. And then I realized that every symptom he had, I had. And he got it from me.
How could you not know?
Well, I knew that I couldn't learn how to read, that I was kept back twice and asked to leave one school, that I was almost 12 when I in the fifth grade, and which I had been repeated in the third grade. So I knew that I had everything that would lead to the fact that I couldn't learn how to read, that I'm terrible with languages, that I always thought that I've had a very curious relationship with answering machines my entire life. I never met one who could record a number correctly, and I would throw them across rooms and become furious with them. Of course, it was the way I was hearing the numbers. I've even asked people, my friends, why they didn't leave me their correct phone number that they... I didn't know until I was, I put it all together. I didn't know that I was dyslexic. I thought that I was... As a kid, I was placed in what they called the dummy class. I was a non-learner. I couldn't learn anything, math, anything. So I just grew up seeing myself as dumb. So when I realized, suddenly I was a poster child for dyslexia organizations, a very good one in Connecticut called the Smart Kids. And I'm asked to give commencement speeches to Churchill School, a dyslexia high school in New York. And an editor heard one of these, read one of these, and asked me to write this book. And in writing the book, I've discovered that my teaching method, my school, the Writer Studio, persona writing, all comes out of this.
And let's not forget how the dyslexia has, in fact, enriched your poetry.
Yes. Well, you know, I went to this event, this large event in Connecticut this last, I believe it was January, and there was a young girl was getting this award. She had won a major science award from NASA, and she said that her dyslexia was her secret weapon, that she realized that it was her advantage to be dyslexic over all the other kids who were the finalists who were trying to win the prize. And she used it, that her way of thinking, that her way her brain worked, the way she had learned to go with the flow, was a big advantage in winning it.
Philip Schultz is now writing a book about his disability. It's called My Dyslexia and is due to be published next year. In the process, he's learning more about the condition.
Since your brain is wired differently from other people's brain, and it doesn't want to do and can't do many of the things you ask it to do, you learn to do things instead of the things that you're supposed to be doing. It's compensatory thinking. You can't do this, so you do this. You can't go here, so you go here. You can't read a map. You can't follow a recipe. You can't learn a language.
So give us an example of what you did in compensation.
I remember trying to teach myself how to read and being sick and tired of feeling so poorly of myself. So I actually created a persona who wasn't me, of a boy who could actually read. I only the last few days I've discovered this in writing. I remember lying in this tiny little room, this bed, creating this kid who could read, who would go on to be a writer, who would go on to read successfully, and then using that persona at school or while I was struggling to read comic books, and one day it worked. I fooled myself into finding a way of teaching myself. They didn't know what dyslexia was then. They weren't able to give you any special services. They had no theories with which to teach someone how to read. So I taught myself. The tutor I had really wasn't working. He thought it was funny when I said I wanted to be a writer. I did everything in a roundabout way, teaching in an academic situation, because I had my own method that I wanted to teach didn't really work, so I created my own school. It was based on the way I taught myself how to read and the way I taught myself how to write.
If you could distill it down, what are some of the guiding principles of the approach that you take?
Persona writing, creating...
And why does that overcome the barrier of dyslexia?
Because the story of dyslexia is a story of anxiety, that when you ask yourself to conform and live in the real world and society, your brain balks at it. It creates an enormous amount of anxiety, and that can lead to depression. Mm-hmm. And what I did, what saved me, was creating this image of someone who was more normal, who could do these things. However well I could ever conform or do these things, I did find a way of, in a roundabout way, of doing them at least adequately. And then finally, when as an adult, I decided to go off in my own direction, teach my own method of writing, have my own school, create personas, create an I who could tell my stories, my poems. I couldn't create the kind of eyes and personas that these other novelists could, but I created. So what I do now, the book that won the Pulitzer, really it was for a long poem, and half the book is called The Wandering Wingless. It's a novel. All that work writing many novels taught me how to tell a long story. So that's, I use that. It's my novel now is comes in the form of verse, and but takes on larger stories.
Now, verse captures a very particular part of the brain. People who do have learning disabilities often are able to learn and to memorize through rhyme, for example. So I wonder if you see a kind of connection there, that the very nature of verse itself capacitates parts of the brain that may not be by the straight, linear, sequential form of thinking that prose is.
You know, one of the struggles I've had in this book, that it's a personal story, it's not science. I have read a number of books on it, and I do know something about dyslexia. An expert would answer that question much better than I could. So any answer I would attempt would be through my own experience. So I don't really know, though, but I'm giving that little caveat. For some reason, and I don't know the answer to that, compression works for me. Because my brain is often all over the place and I process things so slowly. If I go to a toll booth and my wife wants me to ask the toll booth person directions, by the time I hear them, I'm past the exit. I'm supposed to turn off. We have a GPS, and if my wife doesn't sit there next to me saying, left, this left, I don't know my right from my left. Mm-hmm. Today, I picked up my son at tennis, and he was trying to tell me that his tennis instructor had bought him an ice cream and that he wanted me to pay the guy for buying an ice cream. I didn't hear any of that. I thought that I was being asked to pay for the tennis lessons. I was in the car with him halfway home before I understood that he was telling me not to pay for several lessons, but a ice cream. Mm-hmm. that the guy had paid out of his own pocket. And I just didn't hear it. And I laughed. I even said to him, and he's 10 years old, I wonder to myself, how many things do I not hear? I mean, I see how my son struggles with it. It's something that affects you in every aspect of your life. I'm sure my writing poetry, neurologically, there's an explanation, which I'm not sure I understand.
You know, some say that learning disabilities, ADD, some say that actually these engage the right brain kind of thinking, which is more creative, that you don't pick up on the details, but are better able to make imaginative leaps.
Yes, I mean, I would imagine, is therefore the right brain, certainly novelists, it wouldn't explain the difference between poetry and fiction, because the novelists, of course, use their right brain.
Well, yes, but poetry really makes imaginative leaps in a way that even a novel doesn't, that in the sense of, there, as you said, there's the compression, there's the use of the image that bypasses a whole lot of words to go to the heart of the matter.
You know, I have a book in here, it's called Living in the Past, and it's 81 poems, a family about the immigrant experience. And it was really taken directly from a novel, a 300-page novel that I was working on forever. And even though the 300 pages was boiled down from 600 pages, I could never make it work. But when I boiled them down to short little vignettes and poems and things, they're full of leaps. I could do it that way.
Poet Philip Schultz. To hear him talk about and read from his wonderful collection of poems, The God of Loneliness, go to writersvoice.net. We'll continue with our list of top 10 shows for 2010 after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today we're featuring interviews from our list of top 10 shows for 2010. I feel incredibly lucky to be able to talk with so many wonderful authors about their books throughout the year, and it was tough winnowing the list down to just 10. You can always go to the Writer's Voice website, writersvoice.net, check in our archives, and browse through our collection for yourself. Make up your own list of top 10 shows and share that list with other visitors to the website or go to our Facebook page or Twitter feed at Writer's Voice. British author Sadie Jones won acclaim for her first novel, Outcast. Her latest novel, Small Wars, is about what happens to a marriage when the husband goes to war. She explores the themes of trust and betrayal, intimacy and estrangement, and how external violence can create its own echo within a marriage. Tell us about your protagonists. You have Major Hal Traherne and his wife, Clara, and their two children. Tell us first about Hal. What kind of a man is he?
He comes from a family of soldiers, generations of soldiers, and he sees himself and is an upright, honorable man who expects to be a hero in the mold of, as he perceives them, his father and grandfather before him. And he is in this situation in Cyprus in an unconventional, rather dirty war, faced with things that make him question all of his moral absolutes and his own moral self.
You call it Small Wars, but as I was thinking about the title, I assume, a small war in the sense that it's not like World War II. This is, as you say, an unconventional war. But I was thinking that small wars, these small wars, have a great, great impact on the individuals who are in them, as this one does on his marriage. Tell us about his wife.
You're absolutely right that the small wars referred to are not only political and military, but also within this marriage. And it's very much about the impossibility of intimacy for people who face such dreadful things as soldiers have to face. His wife, Clara, is she comes from a much more relaxed, somewhat more liberal background than he does. They're a happy marriage and a romantic marriage, but they're also naive, and they have never had to really face any problems before they've arrived in Cyprus. So they're, like many happy marriages, I think, they're in a precarious situation because they don't have the tools to deal with their problems once they arise.
They don't have those tools, and I'm wondering, first of all, why? In the sense that, can one ever have these tools before one... In other words, are these just things that human beings are not meant to bear, are not meant to be able to process, that we lose our humanity if we were able to process them? Or is there something particular also about this time and place and their own place in it that makes them really unable to deal with what's going on and to communicate across the tragedies that befall them?
I think that's a really good point and well put, because we have a modern habit of blaming people's psychologies and relationships and saying, oh, if only they had had a different marriage or been able to speak out or be truthful, then they would have been all right. But actually, how does a man go and commit violent acts of bloodshed that he may not be able to defend politically or morally, and then go home and be a loving husband and a good father? I think that's asking really too much. And in this situation, oh, it's very easy for us to say, oh, the 50s and stiff upper lip and they didn't really know how to cope with things. But actually, I think any soldier and his wife, she's going to try to accommodate his job, and he's going to try to behave in as human a way as possible, given an inhuman, often, surroundings that he might be in.
He does try to behave humanly or humanely with her, but there is a pivotal point in the book where this breaks down, and it's after probably his first real confrontation with personal violence. Without giving away too much of the book, could you talk about that, what happens? And then he goes home, he finds himself in terrible need of her, and commits what she sees as a violent act upon herself.
Yes, he does. He has had, and he wouldn't have the emotional understanding of it, of his own psyche, but he really, the bloodlust is awoken in him by this act of war that he commits, which is fairly horrific, but also, in the scheme of things, probably quite commonplace. And he's in a state of shock, really, afterwards, and he's submerged in what he has experienced. And he has had this extraordinary violence woken in him that he could not have expected. And I think also any shame or guilt that he feels is denied immediately, because he does not respect his conscience, and that's one of his tragedies as a character. And he desperately needs, as you say, to make a connection with her. And it's a rape, really. And he doesn't hate her. That has none of the hallmarks of a rape that we might expect, but I think it definitely is a rape. And it's a breakdown of trust between them that has catastrophic consequences.
Sadie Jones, talking about her latest novel, Small Wars.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot is just to tell them that I love you a lot, and the world discovers how to make, how to make two lovers a friend.
I spoke in May with Hampton Sides about his terrific book, Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. Sides traces James Earl Ray's journey as an assassin, exploring his complex personality and motivations. I asked Hampton Sides what it was like for him to try and figure out who Ray was.
He is so murky. He is so complicated. And just when you think you have him figured out, he's moved on to another name and another location, another story. His stories always evolve. They're always changing. They're full of lies, but there's always truth embedded in the lies. And sifting through all that stuff is exasperating. It's frustrating. It was like this enormous game that he played with history and with any kind of authority, whether it be, you know, a shrink or a doctor, a lawyer, a warden, and also with writers, anyone who had to interview him. It was like this big cat and mouse game that, and I think he enjoyed playing. He enjoyed sending out these multiple conflicting signals. I often describe him as a squid, who, as you approach him, squirts out this big ink cloud, and you can't see him in there. You don't know where he is, or if he's there anymore at all, or was he lying? Is he telling the truth? What's his story? He mumbled a lot. He changed his alibis. He, you know, constantly evolved and kept up this game that I'm talking about, really, until the day he died.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Hampton Sides about his book Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. And yet, ironically, you say, or you ascribe to him, the motivation to be known, to be seen, to become notorious.
Yeah, it's a weird combination of wanting anonymity and wanting notoriety. He developed a persona that was anonymous. It was very generic. He tried to be in the shadows. He tried to be invisible. He said he wanted to have a face that no one could remember. And at the same time, he did these things, especially this one thing, that was guaranteed to give him notoriety for the rest of American history. And you could see that in his love for the chase, too. He didn't want to get caught, but he always seemed to leave some clue behind that was guaranteed to get him caught so that he'd go back to jail and have to spring from prison again and thus initiate another bigger chase. He seemed to love the chase. That seemed to be a big part of his personality. But a little of a just sort of nuts and bolts background about him. He was born in Alton, Illinois. He lived in a succession of impoverished towns along the Mississippi River Valley in Missouri and Illinois. He was a career criminal, mostly, you know, stick-up. He was a stick-up artist and, you know, armed robbery and cashing money orders. And he basically was in and out of jail his whole life. And then he finally found himself in the Missouri State Penitentiary in Jefferson City, where he endeavored to escape. And he finally did escape in a bread box from the prison bakery that was bound for the Honor Farm, where, you know, some of the less dangerous criminals were working. He hopped out of this bread box and ran off down the railroad tracks and made his escape into history. And so he was a fugitive already for about a year before the assassination. And he found his way to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, and then finally to Los Angeles, where he was up to all kinds of odd things, like he was taking dancing lessons. He graduated from a bartending school. He went to a number of shrinks and hypnotists. He also got a nose job just 1 month before the assassination. He was taking a locksmithing correspondence course. He was aspiring to be a porn director. He was up to all kinds of stuff and was kind of living a life that really showed to me that he was trying on different lifestyles, and he was desperate, I think, to find something to make something stick. He was trying to find some sort of meaning, some sort of happiness. And the thing that seemed to galvanize him, though, through all these eclectic endeavors of his was the George Wallace for President campaign of 1968. Wallace really spoke to him and moved him, and he volunteered for the organization and went around trying to get signatures on the ballot for him and buttonholing strangers, trying to get them to go down to the Wallace office and lend their hand to the cause. So, you know, this was not a joiner. James Earl Ray always, as I said earlier, kind of lived in the shadows, but he joined, you know, he hitched his wagon to this particular cause. And I think he actually believed that Wallace could be elected president. He seemed to be hopeful that this could actually happen and it would, you know, change history.
In addition to Hellhound on His Trail, Hampton Sides is the author of Ghost Soldiers and Blood and Thunder. He's also an editor at large for Outside Magazine.
Oh, oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave. Go home to my Lord and be free.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking today about the top 10 shows of 2010. As regular listeners to Writer's Voice know, I'm a climate hawk. That means I think that climate change is the greatest challenge human beings have ever faced, that we're running out of time to deal with it, and we'd better get serious about it now. Next on our roster for the top 10 shows of 2010 is my interview with Eric Pooley of Business Week about his spellbinding political thriller, The Climate War. It's about who killed the climate bill and how they did it. I spoke with him on a scorching hot day in August. The personalities and the issues that have framed the war over climate policy is the subject of your book. Let's start with one side of that climate war, the deny and delay movement, as you call them. Could you first tell us who are they and who's behind them?
Well, when I set out to write this book, I didn't expect that that would be a big part of the story, because I thought that the debate was shifting from the science to the politics and economics. In other words, from whether climate change was real to what we were going to do about it. But the deny and delay crowd are dedicated to sowing doubt and confusion on this issue, and they've done an extremely good job and have been very persistent. So that question about whether it's really happening or not continues to be a source of real power. It's derailed, or at least helped to derail legislation, because there's about a third of the country that is not at all sure that this is really happening. That didn't happen by accident. That's the result of a concerted effort on the part of paid professional public relations people. The one that I focus on most is a man named Myron Ebell. He's director of global warming policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Now, the CEI is a conservative think tank in Washington that opposes taxation and regulation of any kind. And it's been part of this movement that's been driven by ideology, anti-tax and anti-regulatory zeal to deny the fact of global warming. These are people whose thinking moves from effect to cause. They hate the proposed solutions. They hate the idea of regulating the energy economy. They hate the idea of transitioning from dirty to clean fuels. Not incidentally, they get a lot of funding from the fossil fuel companies. And they are dedicated to a two-front war. One front is the science, and they claim that the jury is still out over whether this is happening. They have a different argument every day. They used to say that there was no global warming. When it became very clear that there was, they retreated to a point where now they say, well, it's happening, but man is not the cause. They argue that it's natural variation, or that it's sunspots, or that if it is happening, we can't do anything about it. They have a different argument depending on the day of the week, sometimes it seems. But it's always consistent that whatever's going on, we shouldn't do anything about it. And then the other front that they're fighting on is over the economics. They say that if we do anything about it, it'll break the bank, destroy the economy, drive the price of electricity up, kill jobs, move them to China. The usual scare tactics that you hear from industry anytime a new environmental regulation is proposed.
Now, that last one, the economics, has been getting a lot of play recently, although, as you point out, I'd say probably all of those arguments have been, surprisingly, some of them being resurrected after having been soundly defeated. You call that the big lie of the climate debate. I'd like to go into this a little bit more deeply later on, but if you could just lay that out for us right now, just some of the broad outline of why that is such a big lie.
The big lie of the climate debate is the notion that the economy and the environment need to be in opposition. In other words, that if you do something good for the environment, you're going to do something bad for the economy. This is an argument that dates back to Ronald Reagan, and it's obsolete now, because the fact is we need to do something good for the economy that's also good for the climate and the environment, and that's transition from dirty fuels to clean fuels. Now, that's not to say that there won't be any short-term costs associated with this transition. Clearly, there will. There's always a great churn in the American economy, and my day job is deputy editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, so I'm intimately familiar with economic theory and the churn of a vibrant, changing, ever-evolving American economy. It's like a great river, and it's what the economic theorists call creative destruction. As we move towards new technologies and new industries, older ones get left behind. We're not using buggy whips anymore, and the print media industry is embattled. These things happen as economies go on, and new economies are created. So that's the larger frame. In the energy sphere, we need to move from dirty fuels that have sustained our prosperity and made it possible for the last century or more to cleaner fuels that can sustain our prosperity and make it possible for centuries into the future. Now, as we make this transition, there are going to be winners and losers. And what we have here is the people who think they're going to be the losers trying to prevent the transition from taking place. So they cast this false choice, if you will, between the environment and the economy. They say if we choose the environment, if we choose to do something about climate change, then our beloved American economy is going to crash. That couldn't be further from the truth. There are new industries waiting to be born. There are new industries waiting to create tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of American jobs. All we need to do is level the playing field, take away the subsidies that the fossil fuel industries have long enjoyed, and put a price on carbon, close the carbon loophole that has prevented us from accelerating the transition to clean energies. Now, closing the carbon loophole is really what my book is about. That's what the fight is over. Putting a price on carbon, this great market failure in all of our energy markets around the world that has allowed anybody who wants to spew global warming pollution into the atmosphere for free. And the argument here is that it shouldn't be free. There ought to be a small fee placed on that. And how do you place that small fee? Well, by creating something called carbon permits or carbon allowances, where if you want to be a major league polluter, you have to buy one for each ton of CO2 that you're going to be spewing into the atmosphere. So that is the heart of it. It's putting a mandatory declining cap on carbon emissions, and so far it's something that the United States Senate has been unwilling to do. So my book follows the battle to get this done, and when I started this, Francesca, I thought I was going to be writing a story with a happy ending, frankly, that it would be the story of how we finally took the first step. a funny thing happened on the way to the presidential signing ceremony, and we didn't take that first step. We managed to pass the bill in the House of Representatives, and then the Senate and the president decided that they weren't willing to fight it. They didn't want to go to the mat for this bill in 2009 or 2010. And just a week ago, the Senate pulled the plug on the latest attempt to get something done. The president did not make so much as a peep about it. And they're all still claiming that they're going to be doing it someday, but they keep kicking the can down the road. And at this point, it's a very old can, very battered from many kicks, and a very long road. And we're not making a lot of progress.
Eric Pooley's book is The Climate War. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the full interview, as well as a link to our interview with climate scientist James Hansen. He also made the top 10 list. We end on one marvelous writer's take on developing character in fiction. Marissa Silver's terrific collection of stories is Alone With You. In it, she explores the ambiguities of character and relationships, especially around our responsibilities to ourselves and others. In being able to explore the ambiguities, you can only do that from a point of compassion for your characters.
I agree with you. I mean, I think that, as I said earlier, you know, to be judgmental, I think, is to not only lose your characters in all their colors, but also to lose a reader because, you know, a reader doesn't want to be told what to think of somebody. They want to decide what they want to think of that character themselves. And the only way that I can write characters in a way that feels where they become palpable and rich to me is to sort of suspend is to be compassionate for their foibles. I mean, not everyone in this book does, you know, a good or right thing in sort of a subjective way. I mean, in an objective way. So, I have tremendous compassion. I don't even think about it in a funny way. You know, when I'm inhabiting characters, I just think about what are they going to do? I feel for them, but mostly I'm just concerned with what they're doing. I'm not even really thinking about, am I compassionate or not? I'm just saying, this feels the thing that they would do.
How does that happen?
It happens in a really slow way. It happens a lot in the way that real relationships happen in life, I think. You know, when you meet somebody, you know very little about them. You have certain cues, what they look like, maybe what they said about something, and you begin to, little by little, knowing them more and more, begin to sort of deepen your understanding of who they are. And, you know, they may behave a certain way in a situation. You think, oh, they're a little different than I thought. You know, your understanding them becomes more nuanced. And with character, it's really the same thing. I mean, I start off with a shred of, I mean, almost nothing, you know, a woman, a girl, somebody with long hair, you know, there might be that much. And then I sort of throw action in their way, and I try to see how they'll behave in the face of those actions, and those that helps me understand them more. And you know, I don't know who they are at the beginning. I'm learning in the same way that a reader is going to be learning as he or she reads the story. So it's a long process of digging deeper and deeper and deeper, and trying to find out what the difference is between who they say they are and what they really are, and what their actions reveal about themselves that might be different from what they thought. I think everybody carries around a certain mythology about themselves, which is often at odds with the way other people perceive them. And then it's a lot about how they are perceived by others. I mean, you know, we are only perceptions of other people. You know, I mean, we may have our own idea of ourselves, but we are known through other people as well. So, you know, it's always thinking about, well, how does another person see that person? So a character exists on so many different levels, and it's just a long, sort of slow, patient process to get deeper and deeper.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with fiction writer Marissa Silver about her latest collection of stories, Alone With You. I wonder if you could tell us about that process in, with one of my favorite stories in this book, although that was hard to choose because there were many that I loved. But that one is Pond.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. I love that story. Pond is a story that's told in three sections, and it is a story about, it begins as a story about a family, a mother and a father and a 24-year-old daughter who's developmentally delayed. So she probably behaves much like a 4-year-old. And she's pregnant. And in the first part of the story, you see the family sort of, dealing with this imminent birth of a child. And then the second part of the story takes place a few years later when the mother and the daughter and the baby are at a duck pond. And the third part of the story takes place about 7 years later when the father and the daughter and the now 9-year-old boy are by a river. And it's a story that was really, I mean, I never know what my stories are about when I write them. And I oftentimes don't know what they're about for a long time after I write them. This is when I really didn't know what it was about. And I kept changing points of view because I kept thinking there's more here. And I need to go, see it from a different angle and see it from a different angle. And so by the end of the story, even I was surprised at what the story became about, which was sort of, it ends up being really the father's story, which is the character who you know the least in the beginning of the story. So it was a really exhilarating story to write. You know, it was a story where I was dealing both with the emotion and also with the form of writing, which was really fun.
How did you alight on the character of Martha?
You know, I don't know. I never know how to answer that question. Characters kind of appear. And I mean, I hate to say that because it sounds so, gooey or, I'm too hard bitten for that kind of thing. But characters do appear. And I mean, they appear, I suppose, as a result of a lot of subconscious thought, a lot of rumination, but not pointedly so. You know, I never start a story by saying, oh, I'm going to write about a girl and her father. And I don't. I sort of suddenly this character appeared and I had the first line of the story. And then I just started going with that. I suddenly had a situation. Here's a woman who's developmentally delayed and is pregnant. What now? Mm-hmm. Sometimes stories start with an image. Sometimes stories start with a line of dialogue. It's really random. And I think that but for me, I guess what draws me into a story is that whatever that inciting moment is for me reaches very deeply into me in a way that I think, oh, there's so much more here to mine. There's something that really connects to me. It's sinking its claws into me. I don't know what it is. So my job is to sort of, wrestle with it until I find out why that resonates with me.
Marissa Silver talking about her short story collection, Alone With You. Well, folks, that's all we have time for today. The other three interviews to round out our top 10 list of 2010 are Stephanie Simon talking about her history of yoga in America, The Subtle Body, historical journalist Bruce Watson on Freedom Summer, his fascinating account of the struggle for voting rights in Mississippi, and finally, our interview with climatologist James Hansen about his book, Storms of My Grandchildren, possibly the best book explaining the science of climate change and what must be done to preserve civilization. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.